Negotiating. Negotiations almost always happen between two parties who both stand to gain from the outcome. That doesn't mean you shouldn't always try to get the price you want, but I find saying things like, "Help me out here, if you can do it for 20% less, I can give you the business as works," much better than outright demands. You rarely have to agree to a deal there and then, and stalling can be an effective tool. People might say, "If you agree to this today, you can have it for this price." But in reality, if they can offer a good price today, they'll be able to offer it next week. So say to them, "That's a good price. If I don't get a better offer, I'll be back in touch." There are four aspects of negotiations that I think are the most important. 1. A deal that allows you to get on with your business is probably better than a cheaper deal that takes time to pull together. You can always renegotiate later on. 2. Know your bottom line. If there's a price you won't go above or below, stick to your guns. Don't blow your budget just to save face. 3. Don't say any more than you have to. Giving away information can be like giving away ammunition. 4. You can always walk away. There will almost always be another deal out there if you don't like what's on the table. Venture capitalists. A venture capitalist firm is typically a large organization that invests its clients' money in new businesses with the hope of producing spectacular profits. These are big city institutions with millions to play with, and they are all on the lookout for the next big thing. Here are three venture capital resources. The British Private Equity and Venture Capital Association, www.bvca.co.uk. 3i, www.3i.com. Apax Partners, www.apax.com. There are some very big differences between VC money and angel money. The obvious difference is more money. The VC's level of investment usually starts where angel investment stops. For me, though, the biggest difference between angels and VCs is that instead of dealing with a fellow entrepreneur, you find yourself talking to an employee. In my experience, the sort of people who work for venture capitalists are university graduates who often delay their immersion in the real world by subsequently studying for an MBA. They thrive in a corporate world, not the commercial world, and are personally motivated by annual bonuses and promotions. They're basically bank managers with a slightly more enlightened attitude to risk. Understanding and accepting the culture clash between entrepreneurs and the kinds of people who typically work for big city firms is the key to getting what you want out of them. Institutional investors play a numbers game. Doug Richard of Library House once told me that VCs expect 9 out of 10 ventures to fail because they invest in such high-risk projects. They therefore need to find the 1 in 10 companies that make up those losses and deliver spectacular rewards. This is not the place to take an investment that offers a 25% return. They want 200% at least. In order to give themselves the best possible chance of the best possible returns, VCs will sometimes make very serious demands on the companies they invest in. That may include imposing a chairman, a financial director, or an intrusive monitoring method. There's a reason for this. When a VC puts money in, they're usually looking at taking your company to a stock market flotation at the earliest opportunity, and so they start grooming your company to look attractive to the markets. They can install non-executive board members, often on a substantial salary for just a few hours' work, suggest you get your accounts done by one of the leading international accountancy firms, and employ a PR agency whose sole job is to get future investors interested in your company. Within weeks, your startup venture can be turned into something that feels more like a multinational, and if that happens, you need extraordinary strength of mind to focus on what really matters. It can be incredibly exciting, but it can also be nerve-wracking. However, with so much expertise around you, it's possible to grow your company spectacularly quickly, and if you hold on tight, you could be in for the ride of your life. Case study. Name: Grant Morgan. Age: 40. Job: CEO, Louis Kennedy. Qualifications: none. www.louiskennedy.com. I left school at 16 with no real qualifications and went to Barnet College in North London to start a course in law. I only managed 2 weeks. Studying simply wasn't for me, so I found myself a job. Unfortunately, I was packing ties in an unheated warehouse in Hackney during winter. Another lousy job. I thought I'd moved up in the world when I got a job working for my Uncle Benny at a trading company in Soho. The company supplied merchandise for promotions, not unlike the free glasses you used to get if you bought enough petrol. Having bought myself what I thought was a nice suit from Topman, it was actually disgusting, on my first day I was sent into a dimly lit basement to assemble torch components for an order. I spent 6 months assembling those torches, but by the end of 6 years with the company, I had actually learned quite a lot about sourcing, manufacturing, and trading commercial products. I still wasn't thinking about making a career out of it, though. In my spare time, I was involved in hospital radio, while writing for a number of satirical publications with my writing partner, Ricky Simmons. Even though these activities delivered little, if any, income, I secretly hoped I might be able to make a career of them one day. At 22, I joined a small business gift company, supplying branded goods to the corporate sector. It was here that I learned how to manage people. I worked for a guy who had a perception of himself that I didn't share, often belittling and deriding his staff, of just two, in public. I knew that if I ever had staff, I would treat them with respect. I could only take his nonsense for so long, and at 23, found myself out of a job. Although I had managed to buy a flat, I couldn't afford to live in it, so I'd rented it out and lived at home with my parents. I might not have had any money, but neither did I have any responsibilities, so I decided to set up on my own. I was quite excited by the trading process, but generic products didn't do it for me. Creative by nature, I wanted to combine the trading with something more exciting, and decided to target the children's sector, as kids' products were fun and had personality. I named my new company Louis Kennedy, which was the pseudonym Ricky and I had been writing under. It's a hybrid of our middle names. My dad was none too pleased. He was convinced that if the business succeeded, Ricky would want his share. However, Ricky remains my best friend. We still write together, and he hasn't mentioned it yet. Initially, I worked from my bedroom, and my then-girlfriend Emma, now my wife, gave me my first order. She worked as a retail buyer, and her company needed 100,000 badges for a charitable initiative. She arranged for me to be paid in advance, and I then pleaded with my suppliers for 30 days' credit, which they gave me, because they knew and trusted me from my previous job. The order was worth £6,000. A few thousand.